going back to our discussion on identities, you only know yourself, right, through the pleasure of the identities that you're comfortable with and the fear of the identities that you're uncomfortable with, right? But there's myriad of other identities of yourself that you have no idea are, you know, how you show up in those unless you try them.
Cue music. Places, everybody, places. We're starting in 3, 2.
Welcome to the Autoimmune Hour, where we look at the rise of autoimmune disorders. I've brought together top experts that range from doctors, specialists, nutritionists, researchers, and even those recovering from autoimmune to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information about autoimmunity and how to live your life uninterrupted.
Thank you for joining us here on the Autoimmune Hour with Sharon Saylor. Always seek sound legal, medical, and or professional advice regarding any problems, conditions, and any of the recommendations you see, hear, or read here on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune, and Life Interrupted Radio. Join the Autoimmune Hour's Courage Club. Sign up now at understandingautoimmune.com. Now, back to your host, Sharon Saylor.
Welcome, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour. I'm Sharon Saylor from SharonSaylor.com. And as always, it's just my honor and pleasure to be with you here on another brand new episode of the Autoimmune Hour. Oh, my goodness. You know what? I am so excited when people who have listened to the show reach out to me and say, hey, this is what I do. And I just get so enamored and thrilled that, you know, we have such a great audience. You are so diverse and so full of knowledge, and I'm just so thrilled because all the way from Australia, we had a guest reach out, and that also just thrills me that this show goes worldwide. I just love that we're able to do that. You know, not just we, but everybody's able to do that now to really make an impact on our world. And that's what our guest, Michael Baltura, is doing today. He is just an amazing guy who is all involved in lifestyle education, health and wellness promotion, and organizational development. I know you kind of go, wow, that's a big mix, but he brings it all together for us to understand about our own self-awareness as well as mindfulness. And he's got an interesting take on mindfulness we're going to talk about as well, because that word is thrown around a lot. And I think a lot of people have multiple meanings of it. I really like Michael's take on it. We're also going to touch on neuroplasticity, because I'm telling you, I found that during the pandemic time, during the lockdown time, I had to really work to stay top of the game. I thought, oh my goodness, if you let yourself vegetate for too long, things could probably slow down. So let me jump right in here. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Delighted to join.
Now, tell us a little bit about, I want to know about your idea of the role of self-awareness. I was really intrigued by that because I think a lot of people think they're self-aware, and you have a different take on like, well, maybe not as aware as you think.
Indeed. Thank you. So one of the elements of self-awareness is that if you start to reflect on it, most of the time we are going through the day on a kind of an automatic pilot. In other words, we do stuff, we interact with things, we talk to people, you know, we watch shows, we do our jobs, we do a lot of stuff during the day, and we have multiple thousands of thoughts every day. But most of that time, we're not actually aware of the fact that we do have the awareness of it. In other words, we're not present to the fact that we are interacting. We're just in this kind of flow where we do stuff and we talk to people, but we're not knowing that we're doing it. And it's that layer of self-awareness where we are aware of being present. We are aware of interacting. So when I talk to you, I'm like being here, and I feel not just, you know, what I'm thinking about and kind of what I want to say, but I'm aware of my body, I'm aware of my breath, and I'm aware of my feelings at the same time. That sort of holistic sense of awareness is missing for a lot of us. And it's really quite helpful because it allows us to stay present with what is real at that moment. What we find is that most of the time we present with the way we think about things, and what we think about things is often not necessarily what's there. We think about past, we think about the future, we want stuff and we project stuff, and you know, we remember stuff. This is great. These are all capacities that our mind has, But it doesn't actually serve us very well when instead of engaging with what's going on, we engage with a conversation in our head about it. And self-awareness helps us to remedy that.
Absolutely. I could think of so many places I want to go, but I want to switch back to just something you quickly said about mindfulness. And when we first met, you talked about mindfulness and you focused on the present moment, not in the present moment, which a lot of people say. They say focus, be in the present moment. Your take on it was no... on the present moment was critical distinction. Let's talk a little bit about that distinction, and then I want to talk a little more about self-awareness.
Yeah, okay, sure. So I think part of that confusion, not necessarily confusion, but part of the conversation around mindfulness being in the present moment is because ultimately, if you look at the source of mindfulness, when you look at the text and the traditions that have brought it up, they all go towards this idea of just being at one with everything that's going on, right? Which is fantastic, but it's a fairly lofty aspiration for all of us, you know, sort of mere beginners in this field. And you can be doing mindfulness for 20 years or 50 years of your life and you still be a beginner, right? There is a lot to shed and sort of unfold in the process of becoming mindful. And so why I sometimes use the language of being focused on the present moment, because it goes back to the idea that there is an observer in the equation that can watch what's going on. And if we learn how to have that awareness of the observer and the present moment, we start to actually come into being present with what's going on, because it's not, you know, it's not our ability to just be at one with everything that's just going to switch on the minute we try to be present. We have to learn how to develop it first through the duality of understanding. Oh, I'm here, I'm watching, I'm talking, I'm being present with the process of watching and talking. And eventually through that process, there is the ability to also maybe be mindful in a kind of more holistic oneness kind of way. But I think that's a long process and a long practice. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes sense to me because I reflect back on what I do for a day job, my nonverbal communication, my body language work. Mm. I talk a lot and I train a lot about the observer role. And people say, well, how can you read body language? It's because the observer is there observing as I am talking. And I loved that when you had that description as in our last chat, because it makes sense, because that's how I do my work too. Being able to focus on not just what you're doing, but what the situation around you is, for me, enhances my self-awareness. Your take on mindfulness and your take on self-awareness play together. And when we think about that in the terms of healing, because we are the autoimmune hour here, and we think about that in terms of our health and our well-being, I find it so powerful to be able to be self-aware and mindful on the moment of what's going on, to be able to help my medical team know what's going on for me. My idea of being able to talk about it at a deeper level than just telling them, oh, my elbow hurts. Well, that doesn't give them enough information, you know, give them enough information that comes from this place of mindfulness and self-awareness.
Indeed, and it's a vagary of the way that our medical system has evolved, where it tended to go further and further into, okay, there is a symptom, how do we treat the symptom? While if you look at the traditional medical system, of course, they were a lot more holistic and they could see that there is a connection between the way you think, the way you feel, the way you eat, and the kind of symptoms that shows up on you know, as a medical issue, right? And so again, I think this idea that you can become more present with the whole self, but be aware that there is the capacity to be aware of that presence that allow you to develop that quality of mindfulness and eventually through that practice become more rested in the present moment. But to do that, you have to start to kind of, you know, unfold this spaghetti of everything that's going on and realize that you have the power to do that. You have the power to kind of watch your thinking and then start to say, okay, well, this thought does not actually serve me very well. Or when that emotion rises, instead of trying to push it, I can just allow myself to feel it and it will pass through me if I do that. So there's a whole art of learning how to negotiate that inner dialogue, the conversation that we have with ourselves in our head, that brings much more spaciousness and openness for us to be not just more present, but to actually be more happy in the way that we are present with stuff.
I think much more adaptable. I want to throw that word out there too, because I find a lot of people identify with their diagnosis. I have, as in ownership have, type of word, whatever the diagnosis is. And oftentimes, and to me, that's a closing in of things. You're like, okay, you just put yourself in a nice little box there, not allowing for the awareness of what brought me here and what will take me from here.
Yeah, beautifully said. If I may, I'd like to take this, you know, line of thinking into a exploration of what I would call identities, right? So what happens to us is that over time, as we grow up and as we interact with different facets of emerging life, so we start with a very small, protected, hopefully, you know, benevolent and loving sort of family kind of envelope. And then we discover that there is a bigger envelope, which might be through, you know, the kindergarten and the prep school and the school. And then there might be a sports club, and there might be, you know, other parts of us that starts to grow as we need to relate with a different set of people, circumstances, and relational kind of constraints. And as we do that, we develop an identity for each one of those, because we have an innate mechanism that curates that identity to feel safe and belong, right? This is the way that our brain is wired. The brain is wired to A, look for, you know, make sure that we are safe, and B, hopefully belong in some way to whatever is going around, right? So as we curate those identities in our head to fit in with different parts of, you know, our life, we actually end up with almost like a, you know, sort of a selection, a menu of identities that is the right identity for the right moment, and sort of make it real for you. If you contemplate about the fact that you show up at work, you show up in a particular way, but that might be very different than the way that you show up with your kids, or the very different with the way you show up with a trusted friend. And this sense of like, okay, which identity am I allowed to wear, or am I feeling safe to wear in this context, is a process that is done subconsciously, but we continuously switch it on and off. And think about it, how sometimes you come home and it so happens that there's no one at home, and you almost feel like you can take off all your identities, or the last one you were wearing, out of the bus or out of the car, and just kind of hang your identities at, you know, sort of at the doorway as you walk in. You can just be yourself, right? So there's this sense of we have to kind of be, you know, relevant to the context of what is going on. And so back to your point, quite often when people get a very, you know, sort of a strong situation, something emerges in their life which is really vital to their understanding of how they understand themselves, like, for example, being sick, or getting some sort of a condition, or being in a car accident, or something that rips apart your daily kind of assumptions about how you are and who you are and who is your identity. And suddenly there's this new identity in the room, which it takes over, and it means a lot to you because your life is kind of depends on it, right? At that point, quite often we tend to freak out and assume or identify with that identity as being the one we are only. And in the process of mindfulness and reflection, again, we want to get to that point of, is there something inside myself? Is there an awareness inside myself which is prior to all those identities? And in that awareness, we can also find healing and growth and strength and, you know, the ability to work with the way we think about our thought, we think about our sickness or our condition, and become more empowered and more engaged with it in a way that doesn't actually make us a victim of the situation.
Absolutely. I love that. As we start, I'm looking at the clock here, Michael, just realized we need to take a quick commercial break. I was so engaged in that. I'll save that my next question or when we come back in just a minute. We'll be right back.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
If you're worried your friend may be struggling, remember, you don't have to be there to be there. You can say how are you or get a fake tattoo. You can ask with an app if it works for you. You could chat on a game, kick off your flip-flops. You can ask on your couch while you binge watch.
Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health. Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Listen and imagine. It takes 5 seconds to send a text, and for those 5 seconds, you're driving blind.
Life is worth more than a text.
Stay alive. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Sharon, and of course you know me from here on the Autoimmune Hour. Maybe you don't know I'm also an author. My latest book is for kids. It's Pinky Chenille and the Rainbow Hunters, a winner of a 5-star reader's favorite review. It's perfect for your early reader and a great bedtime story for your young adventurers. Check it out over at pinkychenille.com. That's PinkyChenille.com. See you there.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Autoimmune Hour. I'm Sharon Saylor from SharonSaylor.com. And tonight we're here with Michael Baltura. Here and deliver such insightful and engaging ideas around mindfulness. People are going to talk about cross-cultural and all sorts of good things. Anyway, he's just a wealth of information about self-awareness. And I think it's really important as one of the things that I've learned in my healing journey here is that it's not just the physical manifestation of whatever's going wrong. There's a way more going on behind the scenes. So Michael, I really appreciated how we've talked about things like self-awareness and just touched it briefly, as well as mindfulness and identity. And in all of this past few minutes, we've been talking about how we talk to ourselves. A lot of times people will go, Sharon, that sounds great, but what happens if I don't know the right thing to say? Maybe I do what you say, I sit down and I get quiet and it's just negative voices or something like that. Mm-hmm. What are a couple tips you have for somebody who says, okay, I want to try it, I don't know where to go?
Yeah, fantastic, for sure. So the first tip I would say is that we tend to forget that there is one constant process that happens from the moment that we get, we're born to the moment that we pass away, we die, and that is our breath. And our breath is almost like the elevator, the magic elevator to become present. In other words, you can't take a deep breath with your awareness focused on your breath without becoming present. And so the quickest trick in the book kind of thing, in our toolbox to just stop whatever is going on. Like if we feel frazzled or someone said something and we feel ourselves reacting and we kind of like get into this, rabbit hole of she said and he said and I said and they shouldn't have, they would have and all that. Just stop and just take a few deep breaths. If we breathe deeply into our stomach, what happened in that point is that, of course, we can't breathe air into our stomach. There's no lungs in the stomach. But what happened is that as we breathe deeply, our diaphragm flattens, right? And that pushes the organs, which is why it feels like we're breathing into our stomach. Well, lo and behold, it's almost like kickstarting a parasympathetic nerve system, which is the rest and digest system of our body. So we have, we have the fear, fight, flight, sympathetic nerve system, which is there to react, is there to protect us. And often when we feel upset, we get triggered by something. It might be conscious or subconscious, but we get triggered. And now we are in kind of like in this roller coaster of reactions and feeling, negative and feeling bad about ourselves or about someone else. And so we're looking for a way to come back into the present moment and restart the system and just taking some deep breaths into your stomach and just being present with that breath is a really good way to just come back to ground level and settle, right? So that's the first trick that I would suggest. And anytime that you react to something, just do that for a sec, because we'll talk about more about neuroplasticity. We have to rewire our brain to be that, make that the default reactions to being upset or to, you know, rising emotions for ourselves, and we need to practice it. Second thing is that I invite everyone to start to notice how thoughts in our head are just, they just come and go. It's a little bit like you're watching a train of thoughts, and one thought comes in and each thought is a carriage. So there's a carriage that includes a particular thought, and it comes and it goes, right? So that's happening the whole day. Some people say between 50 and 80,000 thoughts a day, and most of them tend to be from a negative nature. So if you can train yourself to start seeing that when a negative thought, when this train comes along, instead of engaging with it, which is kind of like jumping onto that carriage and then start to wrestle with the demon of that thought, right? Or with the dragon of that thought, you just, oh, okay, that's the negative thought that tells me that I'm not good enough. And I'm just going to let it pass. And something else will come, right? And so developing this capacity to notice when a thought that is unresourceful, that doesn't serve us, that negates us, that, you know, makes us small, comes through our head, instead of starting to engage with it, just let it pass and say, okay, but let's choose another thought. What's good at the moment? Or what can I do about it? Or, you know, say, for example, I have a conversation with someone who's close to me, and as it happens, they trigger me with something. They say something and I get upset. The tendency for me is to then start to wrestle with that upsetness and blame them or be angry at them, and they always say that, and I remember last time they say that, and we start to go into a whole spaghetti of contorted thinking about the situation. And if we can teach ourselves to just, oh, I'm feeling upset, okay, breathing into the upsetness, and then when I see that upset thought, I said, okay, let me just respect that, but allows that to pass, and focus on the thought that, oh, this is a dear long-term friend. I've been friend with that person for a long time. Let me start with that thinking rather than with the one that I feel injured by whatever they say. That sort of practice is really quite useful.
I love those. Just a couple comments on the breathing. First off, that's the number one nonverbal you're judged on. It's funny, people think it's like your hair or whatever, but if you walk into the room and you're breathing comfortable, what I like to call low and slow, it's amazing. People all of a sudden calm down too, because if you're breathing high and rapid, they think you're in fight or flight. Correct. They may not know that that's just your standby. It seems to be a lot of standby. People breathe high and rapid. So teaching yourself to breathe low, that's the number one nonverbal people will judge you on when you first walk into a room. Another thing I heard, and I played with it, I don't have the science to back it up, but it seemed to make sense, was I was commenting to someone in my body language world about, you know, a lot of things going on right now. People tend to get angry really quick. And they commented on this idea of most people breathe through their mouth in a mask. And it's interesting that the science says that when you breathe through your nose, it's calming to the parasympathetic system. But if you breathe through your mouth, it is agitating to the parasympathetic nervous system. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? So each time I am wearing a mask, hopefully we don't have to do that much longer, but each time I'm wearing a mask, I focus on, am I breathing through my nose? And at the beginning, I was shocked at how often I'd been breathing through my mouth. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? So guys, breathe through your nose, mask or not. You're trying to calm down.
And it makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, if you're running away from a tiger, you're not going to kind of like, you got to get a lot of air in and out, right? But you got to get it in a shallow way. Like you can't really breathe deeply. So you got to breathe a lot of volume very fast. And that's breathing through the mouth. And the brain connects those processes, right, with different states of being. And so, yeah, I would second that. I think that's a great advice to just, again, become conscious of how you breathe and a bit slower through the nose, this kind of presence with the breath. Yeah.
And it's so fast, Michael. You mentioned it. I just want to put an underline under it. One or two deep breaths, you will feel a switch. You will feel a change. It is just surprising to me how fast that reset button will work. I think because it's something we do on autopilot since birth, we don't respect breathing like we should. I'm always in awe at how fast, even if I walk into the room and maybe people are agitated, something's going on, or maybe I'm a witness, I'm the observer of two people over there who are having a trigger moment. If I make sure that I breathe low and slow during that time, and I just keep telling myself, keep breathing, Sharon, you know, deep, keep going, it will shift the room.
Yes.
People will start to breathe low and slow. And I am just always so surprised. So even if you are in those moments of anxiety, changing your breathing will change your anxiety and it will change other people in the room. So
yeah, absolutely.
Your extra little tip for today. I'm such a fan of breathing and not just because of the obvious.
Yes.
So you really hit on some things. And I love this idea of the train, the idea of just watching it go through, maybe waving goodbye as it leaves. That that entered my mind. That would be a nice, fun little thing to be able to do. Very helpful, very helpful. Time is flying and I want to get to this idea because we have only touched on it a bit, but I am so fascinated with all of the recent science, I guess not that recent, a couple decades now, of neuroplasticity and this idea of, I remember when I was young and growing up, a lot of people thought that you'd reached a certain in early adulthood, that was it. And boy, if you didn't, you were stuck. And it was downhill from there.
Yes, indeed. And it seemed that way, right? Because often people have this exuberance and sort of hopefulness and you know, sort of dewy eye kind of sense of like life, amazing life. You started a child, like you live in wonder, and then somehow it all sort of starts to crumble. And then by the time you get to your 20s, you're like, okay, that's, you know, I've got a story, I've got my identity, and now I've got to kind of slug through the rest of my life with this identity. And there's not a lot of option. There's not a lot of, you know, sort of opportunities there. So the fascinating part of neuroplasticity is that what they've discovered through the fact in the technology has evolved to a point where we can look into our brain. So before they used to wait and they figure out, okay, well, there is, you know, less, a little bit of less brain with from a certain age onward. And that must be that, you know, it's grown, now it's stuck and that's it. There's nothing else to go there. Now they can see that basically your brain rewires the pathways, the neural pathways, the neurons in your brain respond to the way that you're thinking. And so if you think in a particular way, it over time, it creates a very a layered password, you know, a path that means that every time those electrical impulses are triggered, it will go down exactly the same neural pathways. In other words, I hear the word coffee and straight away I feel like I need to have one because that's, you know, that's what I've wired myself. I bring coffee because it's probably one of the strongest wiring in the, you know, right across the globe in anyone's brain, right?
Well, I call it the neural shortcut.
Yes.
There are certain words that we have built a pathway shortcut.
Yes, indeed. So you have those neural shortcuts and they are primed to respond to the same trigger over and over again. Now, if you somehow manage to consciously curate a different way of thinking about something and you stick it out long enough, in other words, you get triggered and you think, oh, coffee. Okay, I don't want to drink coffee anymore. Okay, I'll get a cup of tea, right? It's a simple example, but the principle is the same, right? So then every time you hear coffee, instead of going by default to, oh, I need a cup of coffee, you go, okay, I can go to tea. Now you have a different reaction. And if you do it long enough, you look at the research, there's anything and everything between, you know, sort of 21 days and 180 days. But the average, so to speak, is about 66 days. So nine to 10 weeks of responding to an old stimuli, an old trigger in a new way will rewire your brain into a new behavior. And if we can start to work with the pieces of ourselves, the parts of ourselves that we're not happy or that we'd like to upgrade or that we'd like to change, we'd like to drop an old behavior for a new behavior, the best way to do it is to become conscious of how every time we have the opportunity to do so, we behave in a new way. That behavior will create a new, you know, basically a new identity of how you show up in that situation. And that is magic if you think about it, because it means that we are never just stuck in a particular way of reacting or a particular way of behaving. We always have an option to do it. It doesn't matter how old we are, like neuroplasticity happens into our 80s. It's just the temerity and the focus that we need to apply in order to repeat that many times and create that new neural pathways. That's where the power that it has for us to control our life, to change our life to the way that we want.
A couple of questions come up for me. First off, that idea of 66 days, well, interesting. I can think of several times in my life, but I'm not clear on the why, where it was a life-changing moment and I never went back to that shortcut.
Mm.
And so it didn't take more than a few seconds. Sometimes those, so I don't want to discourage people saying, I'm not holding out 66 days. But you can have those moments where something happens and...
Correct. If the imprint of the experience is so powerful that it automatically triggers a different relationship with the situation, right? The rewiring still need to happen over weeks. But you don't need to remind yourself that that's what you want to do anymore, right? So I think the difference in that situation is that it's a little bit like, say that you've got a favorite route of going from your work to home, right? And you always walk that route, right? And we do it in our cars. How many times have you driven from home to work or anywhere that is a regular sort of route, and you realize when you got there that you weren't actually present in the car at all? Like, you know,
how did I get here?
How did I get here kind of thing, right? So what happened is that there is this favorite route, right? But for example, if you drive down that route, right, there's an angry big green hulk, right, on the corner of sort of like 22nd and 3rd Avenue, and you drive into that and they smash your cars, you're probably not going to need to think that that's not a good route anymore. You know that it's not a good route anymore. So you'll start driving through another route. It will still take a few weeks for you to get to the point where you can drive it without being present in the car. But the impetus to change has been so forceful that you don't need that reminder. Unfortunately for us, for most habits, there's no green hulk around it, right? And so we kind of need to remind ourselves to do it long enough for it to take place.
Mm. Good point. Yeah. Now, one other quick question I've heard, and we haven't quite addressed it, that it's good to teach ourselves new things and not just revisions of old things, meaning like, oh, well, I've always done this, I'm just going to now add this little bit. But actually, like, if you have never done ballroom dancing, maybe you should do ballroom dancing or something. Teach yourself something completely different versus continuing to become an expert at what you already know. What's the science behind that? Do I need to take up ballroom dancing?
It will be fun, that's for sure. Okay, so, you know, I'm not an expert on the whole physical, biological, chemical parts of the brain. You know, I wouldn't claim that. What I do is I work as a coach with neuroplasticity. So my limited knowledge in that can say that. What we are finding with the brain is that it's such a complex organism. It's probably the most complex organism that we know of, at least an organic one in the universe, in the entire universe, right? That a lot of processes are happening in a lot of places at the same time. It's not like there is a little corner for ballroom dancing, a little corner for fishing, and a little corner. And the idea is that you wake each corner, then you got more corners awake. That sounds good. No, actually, these are multiple processes that involve multiple parts of the brain. And so it's a little bit like thinking about going to the gym. If you go to the gym and you've always just exercised three muscles and now you're going to go and exercise yet a fourth muscle, that will be great for the muscle itself, but not great for your whole body, right? Mm-hmm. So every time you take a new endeavor, which requires hopefully some somatic interaction as well as mental, cognitive, possibly emotional interaction, that allows for the whole body to exercise in a new way. And we meant to do that. We have this incredible capacity to learn new stuff very fast and to grow into different directions and different sort of fields. And so I think the benefit in this sense is this idea that we take on new endeavors, not just to learn that specific new capacity, but to exercise our brain in a completely new way. So you've done yoga and now you're going to do Pilates. You've done Pilates, now you're going to do athletics. You take a whole new regime of exercise in a way when you take on a new endeavor.
Absolutely. And I found that during lockdown here, gosh, it was easy just to become a couch potato and not even exercise the old exercises or mental stimulation. I found that picking a book off the bookshelf that was someone else in my family, it was their book, and I'd never explored that genre before. I found that was helpful, to read books that I wouldn't normally have picked up and read. And even explorations of that kinds of exercises was really helpful, just staying present in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. If I can say one more thing to that. Going back to our discussion on identities, you only know yourself, right, through the pleasure of the identities that you're comfortable with and the fear of the identities that you're uncomfortable with. But there's myriad of other identities of yourself that you have no idea how you show up in those unless you try them, right? In other words, these conglomerations of our personality that's made out of all those experiences, behaviors, identities, and whatnot is there because that's what we've done so far. But nothing stops us from reinventing ourselves in a completely new way and becoming, you know, someone else in a sense, because we now have a whole new layered way of interacting with the world that wasn't there before, because we picked up a new set of skills. So before we never used to dance, and now we can dance, right? And so now we have a different interactions with music, with people, with the way that I feel about myself, with my body, with my breathing, all that is available for us, but it's potentiated in our experience, but it's not, you know, it's not experienced until we've actually taken that on board. So this idea of discovering ourselves in new ways, that's fantastic.
It is. And you made in this comment, listening to you intently, I flashed back to a few things that happened early in the diagnosis. And it was a messy diagnosis, and there was a lot of healing that needed to happen. And what I remember were people say, oh, you're so brave, or you're so courageous. I didn't know what that meant, because to me, there was no other alternative. But to them, they were seeing an identity of outer manifestation of the diagnosis and putting some sort of limiting factor on that. And I would say, I don't know what you mean. There is no other alternative but to move through this. I mean, they're giving me these identities that really were like, that's your identity. I mean, if you were over here looking out, you'd see like, I'm not particularly feeling very brave right now. I'm just doing what I need to do to get to the other side.
Yeah, indeed. And we can't see someone else's identity if you kind of contemplate that. We can only see someone else through our understanding of their identity through our identity, right? Uh-huh. So in other words, we project our identity onto someone and they say, oh, okay, well, when my identity is in that situation, I'll have to be very, very brave to respond the way Sharon has responded. Therefore, Sharon is brave.
Right.
I don't actually, this is kind of part of the tragedy, but also the opportunity for us to grow. We can't experience someone else's life as they experience it. We can only experience it through our own filter of our, you know, judgments on the words, our fears, our behaviors, everything that we know about the world, perceived is through that, you know, sort of filter, and then kind of formulated into a projection of what that person is like, right? Which is why you have those situations where a couple will go and have an interaction somehow, you know, whether they go out or they interact with friends or whatever, they'll come home and they'll have a very different experience, right? Between, oh no, that happened. No, they did happen like that. It happened like that. And you have a very different memory of what's going on, because you can only perceive your words through your own filter. Which goes back to why it is so useful to develop that capacity to observe without judgment, without kind of getting stuck, getting engaged, or getting, you know, sort of triggered by thinking, because the less of your own thinking that's going on when you're being present with the situation, the less chance that you're filtering what's going on to your own biases and your own inhibitions.
Absolutely. We need to take our final quick commercial break. I got so entranced with all of this. You guys, I could tell I love this kind of dialogue, information, deep learning here. But we'll take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back.
Life Interrupted Radio will return after these messages from our sponsors. It's great sponsors like these that keep this show coming to you every week. Be sure and stop by lifeinterruptedradio.com to learn more.
Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
You came across someone struggling with hunger. How would you recognize them? Would you notice an 8-year-old girl who's not excited for summer break
because she may not be having lunch again until September?
Or a war veteran who's having a hard time
landing a job and getting back on his feet?
I am the 1 in 8 Americans who struggle with hunger. I am hunger in America.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Research shows we apologize up to 10 times a day, and most of the time, we say sorry as a response to someone else's mistake. What if we thanked people instead of all that unnecessary apologizing? So instead of saying, "Sorry, I'm rambling," you say, "Thank you for listening." Join us at ProjectForgive.com, a free, non-religious resource on global forgiveness.
Do you want to be a better leader, have better relationships, become more self-aware, be a better communicator? Hi, I'm Sharon Saylor, best-selling author, professional speaker, and executive coach. And my life passion is empowering professionals to be the best that they can be. After years of working with professionals, I've discovered the 7 things nobody is telling you that can cost you your clients, sales, and even your career. And I want to give it to you free. You've heard my show, you know my passion, and maybe we'll be working together sooner rather than later. So go grab this ebook now to find out the 7 things that's costing you big time over at SharonSaylor.com/radio gift.
Opiates has taken everything and everyone I've ever loved away from me. Everything.
I blew my ankle out and I got prescribed pain pills by my doctor.
If making my detox public is going to help somebody, I'm all for it. I just wish I would have had a warning.
Opioid dependence can happen after just 5 days. Know the truth, spread the truth. A message from Truth, the Ad Council, and ONDCP.
Welcome back, everyone. Oh my goodness, I am so excited. I've been so engrossed in our conversation. I'm with Michael Baltura, and he is from Australia. He has listened to the show and he reached out to me and said, "Hey, let's have a chat." We did and just really hit it off. He's into lifestyle education. He's a coach all about designing our life and understanding an integrated mind-body approach to including leadership education. And oh my goodness, Michael, I could go so many ways here. I'm going to open it up to you. And based on everything we've talked about, just share some more insights with us, because I've been mesmerized.
I would like to share 3 ideas that might be helpful in the context of what we're going through now, right? And so the first is that we assume that we have control over life, especially in developed societies, because a lot of the systems around us work very well, right? So in other words, you turn on the light and the light is there. There's always electricity. And when it might be a very rare occasion, you and I spoke before we started about this one situation where you had no electricity for a few days. And I've just had a similar occasion here because of a storm. But that is a rarity in our life. Most of the time, the systems work and we can assume that we have control over our life. And if you tune into what we're trying to do most of the time is we're trying to control what's going on, right? These conversations with reality that we have, in other words, things happen, circumstances kind of unfold, and then we have an idea of, you know, they should unfold differently to what is going on. And now we're in this kind of like damage control mode where we try to re-engage with it or find a way to control the situation and manipulate it or force it or tinker with it until it goes back to how we think things should happen, right? A lot of the angst from life that we experience as humans come from that sort of argument with reality, that things don't work according to our plan, and we try to keep forcing them, right? And so this notion of having control over life can be quite confusing, because there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's good for us. You know, the fact that we have air conditioners is a derivative or a benefit, a boon that came out of our need to control what's going on. We want to control the temperature around us. Originally, it was fire, right? That's good. But it's the angst that come with it that I think we can learn to work with. And so the first thing that I would suggest is, when something going on for you and it suddenly doesn't work according to how you plan, rather than try and smash your way into, okay, well, I'm going to force it to work like that, just step back, take a deep breath, and just kind of be present with the fact that life has suggested it differently than what you thought it is. Maybe there's something else there. Maybe there's a learning. Maybe there's an opening. You can do stuff about it. But before you rush into doing it, just sit back and kind of watch it happening. And one of the hidden, I wouldn't call it a benefit, but one of the hidden invitation in our situation as a collective around the globe in this pandemic is this gentle or not so gentle reminder by the universe that we're not in control. Because we thought we had it all in control. You know, we had millions of flights going around the world. We had millions of meetings planned. We had, you know, my calendar was full of, you know, booked meeting for 2020 and trips to Europe and all this stuff I was going to do. And then a tiny little animal in a corner of a market, in a corner of China, out in the boondocks, as we say in Australia, within 3 months, shut down the whole planet. And so this notion of being in control, right, is something that is good for us to kind of let go. It doesn't mean that we cannot control our reaction to it and we can control our thinking about it, but let go of trying to think about controlling circumstances, right? The second learning that we have from the pandemic is that we're all interconnected. We connected through our breathing, we connected through the way that we, you know, sort of touch each other, we connected through the way we touch things and other people touch them. And we forget that, but it's good for us to know that. And it's good for us to practice the notion of being kind to that interconnectedness, because it's when we remember other people, when we see other people like ourselves, we can understand and we can show up in the world in a more benevolent and kinder way. And the most weird thing about this pandemic situation is that we have to stop our life. We have to change our life. We have to kill things in our life in order to be kinder and take care of people that we don't even know. How's that for an invitation of understanding our interconnectedness, right? And the third point is that we tend to think that happiness is an outcome of a specific set of circumstances. And I just want to throw into the mix that happiness is a practice of how you interact overall with circumstances, that you have the capacity over time to learn to be happy with the way things are and with the way you show up in a situation through curated behavior that is irrelevant to circumstances, right? And that's where the biggest offer that we have as a human being for us to explore our minds and our hearts is this idea that I can develop a different relationship with myself and with others. And the way that I can do it is through the way that I think.
I appreciate that, because a lot of people think that their thinking is reality. And I appreciate that you pointed that out, that there is a distinction between the two.
Yeah, very different, right. And look, reality still happens when we sleep, but we don't think. So there must be something going on outside there. And it's that duality, learning, understanding that there is life unfolds. I'm present. I'm being with that life. But what I do in my head about what's going on is the quality of my experience. The quality of my experience is determined through the quality of my thinking about my experience. And I have a lot of power. There's Viktor Frankl, the psychologist, says, you know, there is a space, right, between stimulus and response. And in that space, we have the freedom to choose, right? And in that choice lies our growth and our freedom.
Yeah. I want to add a little and right there, Michael, because I think sometimes when people say my thinking about the experience, I want to add my reaction to the experience as well, because I know that we're thinking as the reaction happens, but oftentimes the reaction results before the thought is fully processed. I read a delightful study about curse words and how sometimes people say a curse word when they slam their thumb with a hammer or something, and it makes them feel better. Mm. And that's where I say, you know, the way sometimes our reaction happens faster than our thinking can stay up to it. So I'd like to say our reaction and our thinking.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. But if I may offer just a way to sharpen that.
Yes.
That reaction is an expression of an unconscious set of thoughts.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And it's a little bit like, you know, when you drive the car and you press the, you know, you press the pedal, right? You press the brake. There's a whole stuff that's going on. You know, it's not like you actually, you know, putting your foot on the wheel and slowing it up. There's a whole thing that's set in motion by you pressing the brake, right? And it's a little bit like that. In other words, you can over time change the way you react to stuff if you consciously curate different pathway of thinking about it that then become unconscious in its own way over time. This goes back to that, you know, that example where I said you need to kind of do it long enough for you to stop having to be present with doing it. That's the kind of curve of knowledge. So you're right. Sometimes the reaction is so fast. I remember many years ago, I was living in Bangkok and I stepped out of the house and there was a snake, a small snake on the floor. And as I went to put out my foot, right, I saw that. And I've never jumped so high in my life. I like just, you know, now I didn't need to think that, right? We wired to do all that stuff, right? That's an extreme survival example. But the body and the mind-body organism is made to kind of shortcut those processes to be able to respond and to be able to interact, right? However, all of those responses have learned responses from our previous experiences in life, and they become unconscious. And so there is the capacity to, you know, become conscious of the fact that I'm reacting in an unskillful, unresourceful way, choosing what will be the reaction that will be resourceful. My grandmother used to say, don't do what's right, do what works, right? Because we tend to go, oh, it's the right thing to do. Well, does it work? How does that work for you, right? So choose the response that is the most beneficial, and from that, starts to adopt the language and the thinking that allows you to grow into that behavior.
Mm, absolutely. And you could see why Michael and I have chatted off the air before we had him on the show. We're down to 3 minutes, Michael. You and I could just chat forever. We've had such a delightful time getting to know each other. And it's been such an honor to have you on the show. Please tell us a little bit more about how people can find out more about you and your coaching.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a delight to be here and thank you for inviting me. So basically, if people want to reach out to me, best is to go to my website. The name is Happy Habits, which if you think about it as an expression of positive neuroplasticity, is how to create a positive, happy kind of interaction with the world. So happyhabits.com.au, because I reside in Australia. And in that website, you see two opportunities to engage with me directly. Either if you want to, you can reach out and shoot out a message for me. If you have any questions, I feel very privileged, grateful to be able to do this kind of work. I coach and train people who want to basically be, you know, learn to have a happier relationship with themselves and life. And so reach out to me, send a message, we'll engage, we can jump on a call. Or if you want, you can download a report, or rather than a report, it's more of an exploration on the 5 new ways of thinking about yourself that allows you to become more engaged, more happier, more expanded with your own life. Either those ways will get us connected, and I'll be delighted if you do that.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. I love stimulating conversations like this that I know all our listeners do too. They just enjoy pushing themselves to think differently. And that's what I appreciate when you reached out to me. And everyone, it's Happy Habits. .com.au. You'll have that up on understandingautoimmune.com. There'll be a little more written about Michael as well there at understandingautoimmune.com. Be sure and join us at Facebook, Understanding Autoimmune, as well as Instagram and Twitter, Understanding Autoimmune. Everyone, have a great week, whatever your adventures. Be sure and have adventures, guys. That's what keeps some of that neuroplasticity going, right, Michael?
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
That's be amazing. Sure and have adventures, guys. Join me next week for another brand new episode. Enjoy.
The information provided on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune, and Life Interrupted Radio, including the websites understandingautoimmune.com and lifeinterruptedradio.com, plus social media, is for educational purposes only. What you read, hear, and see on the Autoimmune Hour, Understanding Autoimmune, and Life Interrupted Radio, and its websites, and other media outlets, is based on experience only. The information should never be used for any legal, diagnostic, or treatment purposes.
In the next few moments, take a nice deep breath. And keep breathing, enjoying that breath as you kind of shake it all out. Let it go. That's right, just shake it out. Shake everything out. That's right. Just right. That's right. Grateful for this moment right here, right now. Feeling every bit of you alive and well. Feeling healing and soothing and calming energy just tingle throughout you. Getting stronger with each breath as your gratitude begins to grow. Oh, that's right. Wow. Taking the last few minutes of our time together here right now just to enjoy this growing gratitude list that grows with each moment, each minute, each hour, each day. That's right. And coming right back now, alive, full of energy, happy to be here, in joy, that's right, and feeling grateful for every moment that you have right now. Oh, wow, welcome back. Go in gratitude and enjoy your day.